Hello and welcome to the Indian Dream Podcast. I'm your host Siddharth Betala. Today we're going to be talking to someone who has contributed in building a 900 crore annual revenue mattress brand as a marketing director and also started a D2C mattress brand that does close to 250 crores in annual revenue. Before we get to the details of the person we are talking to today, let's look at the mattress industry. So mattresses. It's one of those boring and unsexy industries, and as we've often discussed on the podcast, these are perfect for building a large profitable business. The mattress industry in India is estimated to be 12,000 crores, of which 60% is still unorganized. A lot of headroom for growth for the existing organized players. Traditionally, three players dominated the industry: Kurlon, Duroflex and Sleepwell, all legacy companies built over decades. Then between 2016 and 18, at least 10 new D2C mattress brands popped up, some of which have survived and grown to more than 200 crores in revenue in the last 5 years. Talk about disruption. What makes today's episode interesting is that we got a chance to talk to Matthew Joseph, who not only is the third generation entrepreneur of the family business Duroflex, but he's also the founder of a D2C mattress brand called Sleepyhead. What makes his journey fascinating is that he saw the upcoming disruption from the online D2C players, and instead of fighting to defend the legacy brand of Duroflex, he set up a completely new brand and business entity to start Sleepyhead, targeted more towards the millennials of the country. In the conversation today, we talk about the mattress industry, the value chain and manufacturing process of mattresses, the different types of mattresses, the reason D2C mattress industry has scaled so well in the last 3-4 years, how he has built Sleepyhead's brand, and most importantly, which is his favorite mattress. Without further ado, let's jump onto the conversation with Matthew. Actually, you know what? One quick favor to ask. If you're interested in contributing to building the Indian dream, we're looking for content researchers, video editors, content writers. So please do reach out to me. My number and email are in the show notes. With that, let's jump onto the episode. Matthew, I'm very excited to host you on the Indian Dream podcast. You've had a very fascinating journey building Duroflex and Sleepyhead. So, you know, nobody better to talk about the mattress industry, the direct-to-consumer mattress industry, other than you. Where I want to start from is understanding a little bit about how the mattress industry evolved in the late 90s, 2000. I'm assuming it was a, you know, very unorganized sector that slowly got organized. You joined in 2010. If you can give me a brief history about Duroflex and the overall sort of mattress industry right before that, that would be great.
First of all, thanks for having me, guys. Really glad to be here. Very excited to share my story as well. So I joined Duroflex in 2010. I would say the entire mattress category would have been not more than about 6,000 to 7,000 crore maybe. Fair to assume only 30 to 40% was organized. So, you know, maybe 60% was unorganized. You know, a big note, we're talking about a 7,000 crore market at that point in time. Maybe 2010, we would have been a billion people at that point in time. So the entire category itself was very small and very limited, you know, credible players in the segment. Further to add, the products, to be very honest, was very confusing to a consumer. I mean, you know, there were many different products to offer, but I don't think there was enough education for a consumer to really understand what product really suits them. So it was very important for a very credible brand to actually really understand what the consumers need and, you know, really dissect and, you know, start relooking into products from just like a commodity perspective to a really value-added perspective to a consumer. I think for the next 5 years from 2010, and that's exactly what Duroflex did. I mean, we really understood what the consumers need, and we moved our product portfolio from, let's say, a very basic naming convention to a, you know, coir foam or a spring mattress to, you know, a need-based proposition. So we recategorized the entire product portfolio to energize, durapedic, natural living or essential. And, you know, these were the needs. When we did a study with our consumers, and I think we did a in-depth study with about 2,000 consumers, and what they brought in was very fair and square. You know, they wanted mattresses which doesn't give them back pain, or they wanted mattresses to help with the back pain. You know, there's another group of customers which said, I just want to wake up, you know, really fresh and, you know, ready for the day. There's another set of customers who said, you know, I do not want to sleep on, you know, chemically based mattresses. And that's exactly where, you know, our portfolio came in: energized, durapedic and natural living. So, I mean, once we did that, I mean, the consumers could really resonate with what we had to offer, and That was one of the big winning propositions which we had, and we had a good run from 2012 to about 2020 and still going strong.
Matthew, I have a question, right? This is 2010. Was this change, because this seems like a big change in how the company operates, right? Which also means a change in culture, a change in personnel and stuff like that. Was this externally driven? Was there competition emerging in the market where you realize that, okay, if we don't do something now, somebody's going to come eat our market share? Or was it internally driven where you said, okay, this market is moving away from us. The current set of, you know, product convention that we have or how we market our products just doesn't cut it. This is the next phase of growth. How did that happen? That's the first part of the question. And second, tactically, how does an organization that's been doing something for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in a certain way move and say, okay, we're going to do it this way?
Especially a family-run business, right? Where changing the minds of the older generation and all of that is not an easy task at all.
Yeah, so very good and little complicated questions, but yeah, it's quite true. I mean, the entire point which we had to do was reinvent ourselves. I mean, in 2010, I can fairly say we were not there in the top three brands in India. We were probably number four, number five. So, you know, it was not about what the competition was doing. It's about how we actually win competition. It was really reinventing yourself so that, you know, there's a new working culture within the company. You know, people need to start thinking outside, move out of their comfort zone, you know, really challenging new ideas. And that's what we really believed. And to further add on to what Siddharth was asking, so we are part of the third generation of the business. And we were fortunate to, being given this business from, you know, our grandfather to our fathers. And I've got three other cousins who are fellow promoters with me in this journey. I think it was fair to say we came in new and we didn't really have any baggage of, you know, how we should be thinking. And, you know, once we realized that how the current mattress industry at that point in time was formulated was primarily addressing to a need which was 30 years back. But the need has changed dramatically over the last 30 years. And it was our chance to ideate and really come out with a new strategy to, you know, really give a new face to Duroflex.
So, Matthew, at this point in 2010, and I clearly remember this, I remember before that, mattresses were quite disaggregated. If you wanted a new mattress, you'll go to some Raddiwala, you know, in Bombay at least, you'll have that guy coming along with that string, playing that string very loudly. You'd go down, you'd get your mattress redone. And then you guys were part of that whole renaissance of mattresses. And at that time, you were the marketing director at Duroflex. And you were the one who was leading a lot of that change in the way your marketing, your communication was happening, right? So can you take me through some of that? Like, how did you go through all of that rebranding? How did you think through the marketing strategy? You told us part of it. You did a survey of 3,000 people. But that's just one small part of it. You took that survey. What did you do with it? You changed the products. But how did you change the way that you were doing marketing?
A couple of things again. See, I think we are very fortunate to be in India. We have a very young population. If I'm not wrong, I think a couple of months back when we actually relooked into, you know, the Indian economics, the average population of India is still, you know, sub 30, or it's in 28, 29. So we really have a young population. So that really helped. I mean, you know, people are definitely looking for something new. And like how we mentioned, Siddharth, the traditional way of making mattresses has been there for 30, 40 years. And, you know, all of a sudden, a brand coming out with a different kind of communication with a very technologically driven product, you're creating a lot of curiosity with regard to what, you know, we have to deliver. And once we use really credible sources to actually communicate a very strong message, it really works. So a couple of things which we really need to pass on is, I mean, let's be very honest. I mean, mattress is not a very exciting category. It's a very boring category. And you need to have very strong faces to, you know, build in that trust to the consumers. So, you know, we had multiple associations with very strong, credible individuals like, you know, Milind Soman, you know, the RCB team itself, to actually communicate all these messages across, because it creates a lot of trust when it comes from people who, you know, embodies that kind of a spirit. We were quite proud. I mean, the campaign which we did with Milind Soman was actually, you know, going viral at one point in time. And, you know, it's about creating curiosity again, right? And we all know Milind Soman's known as the, you know, Iron Man of India. And, you know, we made him, I mean, through this campaign, what we did is we made him tweet saying he's going to run a 8-hour marathon. And that created a lot of you know, curiosity amongst, you know, media, amongst his entire fan base, saying, you know, no one's ever done an 8-hour marathon. And, you know, the end message was, you know, 8 hours of good sleep marathon in a good, you know, mattress where it gives you absolute rest and, you know, really brings, you know, gives you a lot of energy for the day. So when you actually think out the box in terms of how do you communicate a very strong message, I think your consumers will listen to you. And like I said, India is a very young country and we are always looking for something, you know, very innovative and what's new in the market. So that also really helped to move away from a very traditional mattress approach to a, you know, more technologically driven approach.
I think this summarizes sort of the first 5-6 years of you coming into Duroflex, making all these changes happen. As I could imagine, this would take a while to, you know, it's a large ship that you're turning around. It's not something a young, nimble 5-10 people that you just say, we are going to focus on this, right? So you took those 5-7 years. And I think something there, I'm assuming, led you to believe the market is changing again and in a big, significant way. For you to say, I'm going to, you know, leave the position that I was, you know, leave the work that I was doing at Duroflex and completely build a new brand, which whatever said and done, right? You obviously have the know-how from working at Duroflex. You probably have the manufacturing support from Duroflex, but creating a brand, going out and creating a new brand, when you're talking about Duroflex, that's a brand that's been there for 30, 40 years at that point in time, that would have been a very hard call. What led you to take that call that I'm going to move away and build a completely new brand called Sleepyhead?
I think it's within the Indian blood to always think what can be done new. So like I said, again, we are blessed with, you know, 1.4 billion people today. When we are doing this exercise, and I think I mentioned this before, you know, speaking of today, which is 2022, we're still speaking of, I think the mattress market has grown to about 12,000 crore today. And still for 1.4 billion people, 12,000 crore is a bare single digit, you know, penetration of the segment into the Indian population. So what we also realized at that point in time is there is this whole young audience who are getting exposed to a lot of, you know, online e-commerce, you know, majority of the population are, you know, getting there are Gen Z and millennials. And when we looked into the Indian economics, we were looking at, you know, the e-commerce contributing to probably just 2% of India's GDP. I mean, today is at maybe 4.5 to maybe 5 or 6%. And at that point in time, and when you look at the population which you have to cater to, you know, it was important that we actually make the shift. And the way we were building Duroflex was to be a, you know, mass premium brand. This is a brand with very technologically driven products, much superior quality. But the audience coming to the e-com space is not really that today. You know, if you actually look at how the cell phone market evolved in the e-com space, probably about 10, 12 years back, I don't think people have thought, you know, you can probably sell a 1 lakh or 1.2 lakh iPhone online maybe 10 to 12 years back. It's a trend people need to, you know, consume. It takes time. So today the online market is a bit nascent in terms of, you know, people adopting very high quality, high priced product. But it was important that we be there from day one so that, you know, you can actually learn, you know, where this market is going to. And believe me, the online space changes almost every day. The need for the consumer changes almost every day.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, any new brand coming up with a better service, that becomes a new benchmark. So it evolves almost, you know, on an hourly basis. So we wanted to be part of that journey as well. And we knew because of how we are positioning Duroflex couldn't possibly play in the same segment. And that's why we pivoted to a new brand, which is much more young, much more colorful, you know, young, vibrant. And, you know, we always knew mattress is a very boring category. And, you know, the way we've positioned and, you know, made the brand Sleepyhead is definitely to address an online audience. So that's why we made it very colorful and exciting. And, you know, a new campaign itself is, you know, away from just resonating to anything which is comfort. We new campaign is called Fun and Fabulous. So, you know, it's very different from a very traditional approach in terms of how we sell mattresses.
Okay, so that explains why you wanted to do it, why you wanted to do it differently. I want to zoom in a little bit on how did you go about executing this, right? Because this is something that we are seeing where a lot of these family-owned businesses are now seeing their next generation come in. The next generation obviously comes in with new insights because they are the target segment, right? And they know what's going to resonate with the target segment along with me. They want to make certain changes. And I actually personally know of many of those people who had those bright ideas but couldn't make it work in a traditional family business setup, because you just don't get the same kind of buy-in, or you don't get the same kind of execution speed, all of those things. How did you execute on the sleepyhead idea? Was it, I'm going to let you tell us, how did you decide to execute on this?
Yeah, so very, very good question. So I think we were very fortunate to have a very stable running business, which was Duroflex, state-of-the-art manufacturing. We were very well backward integrated to make pretty much all the components of the mattress. We are very particular in the quality of products which we give. So, I mean, from day one, we always looked at how do we backward integrate so that we have control on every aspect of the material going in. So when we had a very solid base in terms of manufacturing, process, people, it was easy to plug out, use all these facilities and processes. But what we did a bit different is I put in a new team because we really needed different thinking for online. It's a different thought process. The way of business is different. The different complexities which come in when it comes to online. So I put in a new team, but we leveraged the entire system which we have from Duroflex. So that really helped in terms of, reducing all the capital investments which we need to put in for manufacturing. And I could increase the efficiencies at the Duroflex factory so that we got cost efficiencies. So it worked in multiple ways. So you use what is absolutely required from Duroflex and, build in a separate team so that, the thinking is different for an online consumer. So again, in terms of sales process, Duroflex traditionally followed a dealer-led model. And here we were, going directly to a consumer model. So every aspect of business need to be changed in terms of, your first mile logistics, your last mile logistics, your customer experience. Everything was a very important aspect when it came to sleepyhead.
So over here, Matthew, you just mentioned how you had to change everything in the entire process, right? And that's basically the entire, what we would call a value chain. Where there's the manufacturing, there's the logistics, there's the service to the customer. The manufacturing, I'm assuming, was being handled by Duroflex, right? You guys were buying it from Duroflex. But first, let's just talk about that. What exactly is the manufacturing process for a mattress, just out of curiosity?
End of the day, making a good mattress is a combination of 4 or 5 key different raw materials. So it could be foam, it could be spring, it could be coir. Now, when I put it that way, it becomes very easy for anybody to make it. But what really pushes the boundaries is the amount of knowledge which we had to make a mattress which kind of suits a good amount of audience in India. And, there are many aspects which needs to go through to actually make a good mattress. The durability of the mattress, the support which gives to the consumer, how much it needs to really help this particular individual throughout the night so that, they wake up completely refreshed. Now, where it gets complicated is it also is very dependent on, individual. Every person has a different body type. Every person has a different sleeping pattern, the positions you sleep. So I think at that point in time, Duroflex would have sold to at least 10 to 20 lakh different customers that we had all this data to really understand what kind of products really works. And that kind of R&D was brought into Sleepyhead in terms of, getting the right product. And in Sleepyhead, we have only 4 different mattresses, whereas in Duroflex, we have about 40 different mattresses depending on what kind of sleeper you are, what need you need and all that. But the portfolio which we have in Sleepyhead is a very small portfolio because we understand it's a different set of consumers which we are offering.
Now that we spoke about product manufacturing, one of the things that we love asking our guests is, what does the value chain of this industry look like? So as a consumer, and I was very ignorant about mattresses till I started researching about Duroflex and Sleepyhead, and you said the number of SKUs that are out there, right? The number of different products. And because mattress is one of those things that I want to talk about this point later in time also, it's a purchase that I do once in a few years, right? So how do you understand the lifetime value? But we'll get to that later. Now that we were talking about product and manufacturing, can you help us understand what is that value chain? Where does this originate? And where does the key R&D sort of apply? Like what stage does the R&D differentiate company A from company B?
Yeah. So like I mentioned before, we are almost fully backward integrated to the extent, you know, let's take a product called rubberized coir mattress. Just to give you a very heads up understanding, before PU foam came in, I think most of India was using rubberized coir mattresses. Speaking a little technical, one of the bonding agents for rubberized coir mattress is something called latex. So the quality of latex matters in terms of how well you can bond the coir within. So we've gone, when we say backward integrated, we have farms which makes latex.
Oh, wow. That's backward and integration for sure. Yeah.
So we have farms which makes latex, and we have another sister entity which is the largest exporter of latex from India, which is called Cocolatex. So we've been exporting to US, Europe, Japan, South Korea for the last 20, 25 years, Germany. So when I say backward integrated, we are backward integrated till the farms. And let's say, I think about 15 to 20 years back, one of the biggest requirement which came from the US and European market was, you know, they were very inclined to get organic latex. So which means we couldn't even use chemicals for our plantations. So, you know, that was another 5 to 10 year journey which we took, that, you know, to really understand plants, to get best yield from the plants and still use organic manure or organic feed to these plants so that our farms are organic certified. So today what Duroflex uses, and you know, in Sleepyhead also we have a range of mattress called the Laxi, are organic certified latex. So for us, backward integration means go back to the absolute end, so that, you know, we monitor every aspect of production quality of every raw material goes inside.
So Matthew, that's what you're telling me is that you provide a farm to table mattress, right?
Farm to bed.
Farm to bed.
Yeah, another way of putting it, yes. Yeah, but that's farm to bed. But that's just one product in the portfolio. So another significant raw material in mattresses would be PU foam. So we do have two plants which fully make the entire PU foam, and we have about 30 grades of PU foam which goes on different grades of mattresses depending on what kind of feel the customer requires for their comfort, from regular memory foam to viscoelastic memory foam. From a layman perspective, that's called memory foam. You know what I mean? Yeah. So viscoelastic polyurethane foam and latex like polyurethane foam. So we have the entire portfolio of PU foam, and we have state-of-the-art machines which actually makes these products, to the extent our factories are IKEA certified, and we supply to IKEA as well.
I have some friends who are IKEA certified as well, and they took me through the entire IKEA certification process. It is quite a process. So congratulations on that.
It took us about 18 to 20 months to actually get that. So, and systems and processes to be very.
Yeah. I'm not surprised at all. But my question was on what exactly is foam? Because I keep hearing about foam. I see it inside my bed when my dog ties it up. What is foam actually?
So foam is a byproduct made from a petrol-based product. It is primarily made of two chemicals called polyol and TDI, which is toluene diisocyanate. And the chemical reaction of these two with some blowing agent and water, it's going a little technical, is how you create polyurethane foam. And end of the day, foam is the comfort layer which you actually provide to the customer, so that, you know, you're not sleeping on a very hard spring or a, you know, very hard Koya surface. It's the component which adds comfort.
The only reason I asked Matthew was because I feel like I've had so many conversations about foam, and like talking to you as well, we keep talking about foam. And then during this conversation, I realized I have no idea what it is. So I felt like you were the best person to ask. And also, I had a conversation many years ago with somebody who was talking about how the entire foam industry is completely disorganized.
Yeah.
And that he at that time was saying, is that one of the big opportunities, like trying to organize the disorganized foam market. Whether or not that's a good business is a completely different thing. But Siddharth, do you have a question?
Yeah. Coir, foam, spring, those are the three sort of different materials depending on the kind of mattress that you're making. Within foam, as you said, there's a lot of research that goes on. Is this where the key R&D happens, or where else is the key R&D? Is there something on top of the foam that requires more R&D? I'm just trying to figure out where the R&D comes in.
Yeah, so the R&D happens at two stages. The R&D happens at the raw material stage as well as the mattress stage. I mean, once we've designed a mattress, I think the mattress goes to at least 8 months to a year of R&D just to really understand it meets all the criteria in terms of, all the aspects in terms of what we, we're going to name it Duraflex or a Sleepyard, right? So it's very important that it meets all the criteria. So you can't judge a mattress's efficiency or quality in a day or two. So it goes through at least 8 months of testing or, different levels of testing to really understand if it really fits our portfolio. So it's not really determined by, just giving to a customer and, waiting for the customer to come back and say, oh, it doesn't work for me. No, we have something called the rollator test and many different aspects so that we meet all the criteria.
Okay, so once it's designed, there is some R&D to figure out, how to take it to, I'm trying to understand. The question is going to make a lot more sense when we talk about the industry, the online industry, right? What I'm trying to get to is around when Sleepy had started, which is 2017-ish, right?
17.
Yeah. There was a slew of these online brands that came up, right? Pretty much everybody that is decently big in the industry today started in that 2016 to 18 period. I don't know what happened suddenly, but if there is so much R&D that has gone in, if there is so much, moat that you can build because of product R&D and stuff like that, I would think it's not as easy for an online brand to come up. You came up because you had the Duraflex experience and the manufacturing capacity. How did the other players came up in this industry? Was the R&D sort of open sourced in certain way where a lot of these contract manufacturers could do the same thing? Or are the product qualities very different? I'm just trying to understand how did the industry suddenly move to so much online in 2016 to 18?
Yeah, so two aspects. One, I think we would have seen a lot of brands coming in from 2016-17 is primarily because, they would have realized doing business offline is a bit more difficult and complicated because like I mentioned before, you cannot start a very large distribution network and a dealer network overnight. If I have to speak on Duraflex, we have a dealer network of maybe 6,000 dealers across India. And that is not achieved overnight. I mean, it's achieved through, a long-term relation, how we treat them as a partner, how comfortable they are to deal with our products, the trust which we built between the partners. So any new player coming in, with the rise of marketplace like Amazon and Flipkart, it becomes easy for them to just place the product and, the product being, available to any consumer to buy. Now, to your second question, how did a lot of people get a construction right? Unfortunately, it's pretty easy because they can just rip open any good brand to really understand what is inside to replicate the same formula of variation. But what differs is it the same quality of material going inside which any other person use? Nobody would know. Only time will tell, or a consumer who's using it inevitably, if they have a bad back or a spondylitis which is created due to bad sleeping posture, only those aspects will really kick in. And till then, they kind of get away, which is, to be very honest, a very unfair place to be in. But unfortunately, that's what's being done. They kind of copy, you know, a brand who's already done the work to, you know, eliminate at least 5 to 6 years of research to actually jumpstart their game.
Yeah, this is such a such a interesting problem to solve for that happens across different industries, software or, you know, where I call it the second mover advantage, which is let somebody else build the market, let somebody else do the market research, let somebody else figure out the product R&D, and then you come in once everything is ready. And even if you have a slightly, you know, subpar product or slightly inferior product, there's still a market when you're talking about 1.3, 1.4 billion people. There is still a market for that product, right? Change the pricing slightly because you're using material that's cheaper, and you can do so much more there. As you said, it's unfair. But with that sort of question overhanging, the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years now, right, of building Sleepyhead and building it into an online first D2C brand, what have the learnings been in trying to crack the D2C market for mattresses? Which also logistics is another sort of beast, I would assume, when it comes to just...
I was saving that question for when Matthew finished this answer. I was going to ask specifically on
so
logistics.
So tell us about the journey of the last, you know, 5-6 years of building a D2C brand. What have the learnings been? And what's been the most challenging part of figuring out this in an online first way?
So, very good question. Like I said, Duroflex was primarily from a distributor dealer-led model, which in turn meant we never kind of spoke to the customer directly. We, you know, always kind of got customer feedback from either a dealer or a distributor, where the refinements which we need to do to, you know, offer a better experience was delayed. Now, what happens when you're selling directly to a consumer? You're speaking to the consumer directly, the consumer's asking you questions directly, you kind of become the seller, you kind of become the manufacturer, the seller, and the delivery partner, everything, right? I mean, it's just not one aspect which, you know, is with you. You now not just making good mattresses, you're now making somebody's, you know, life positive. I mean, by, you know, offering them good service, good product. But, you know, for a customer, it doesn't really matter who's delivering the product, who's manufacturing the product. End of the day, you know, the only line which makes sense to them is I paid X, I need to get a good product and I need to get a good service. And that should be the defined element of how you plan your entire business strategy. Because it doesn't matter logistics company X or logistics company Y is delivering, but if the delivery experience is bad, they end of the day they bought from Sleepyhead, so I mean I got a bad experience. So that is one aspect which anybody needs to really rethink and really write onto, you know, your office wall, saying, you know, customer experience is king. If you do not deliver a good customer experience, you know, you're not going to surpass beyond 6 to 8 months. Now, couple of other things which we did slightly differently, right? I mean, if you look at mattress, it's a big rectangular product. Because we were making, you know, primarily foam-based mattresses, we also adopted a technology where you can compress and roll pack the mattress in a small box. So if you go to Sleepyhead website, you can see the mattresses comes to you in a very small box, which is 1/4 the size of an actual mattress, where the logistics kind of becomes very easy. And number two, you know, you're giving a different kind of an experience when a customer is buying a product. I mean, traditionally, they've seen a big mattress coming to your home. Today, I mean, we get so many videos from our customers where they send us their unboxing videos because it's so much of an excitement to actually see a mattress which is rolled up like a small spring roll, you know, opens up to be a big, 8-inch mattress. Or a queen size mattress. And, you know, that kind of a different experience is where we actually held on to create further, excitement for the brand Sleepyhead.
I have a clarifying question over here. When we were talking before the show, you were talking about how you always like to keep inventory of your mattresses so that you can ship it quickly so that, you know, people don't have to wait. Totally fair. You're also saying that you box up your mattresses and you ship it. So when you're now, we all know mattresses are huge, right? They take up a lot of space. And you probably, I know you have many SKUs of mattresses because mattresses, they are different sizes, different preferences, all of that stuff, right? inventory, in my head, inventory becomes a big problem. Do you store it in the box? How do you manage that?
Yeah, all the sizes are compressed, rolled back to a single box. And one box occupies about maybe less than 2 square feet of space.
So that innovation itself happened because of the online industry, right? Because was this there before the dealer, when it was dealer and
Yeah, so it was launched in the US. We just adopted it in India.
Launched by Casper, right?
Casper, yeah. So with all due credit, they did a phenomenal job in terms of really, bringing down the volumetric weight of the product so that logistics and last mile become so easy. So that's the same technology which we've adopted for Sleepy Aid. So typically what a regular traditional mattress occupies about 8 to 10 square feet of space, this box occupies just about 1.5 square feet of space. So yeah, our mattresses are compressed roll packed, and the fact that we use very high quality material for our foam, you can actually compress and roll pack and stock it for even 1 or 2 months and nothing happens to it.
So the unit economics of this entire industry wouldn't have worked if Casper didn't invent it, right? Because if I can imagine the shipping and logistics being such a big bottleneck, both in terms of cost and efficiency, that you can't scale the industry to what it is today.
It was a matter of time, Siddharth, to be very honest, because we've always been doing that with pillows. I mean, you get compressed roll pack pillows. It was only a matter of time, someone actually building a machine to actually compress. I mean, that's what we really didn't have. I mean, we had small machines to actually compress roll pack pillows, but to actually compress and roll pack a mattress, you probably need a machine which can compress the whole mattress, applying about 6 to 8 tons of force so that you compress a full 8-inch mattress or 10-inch mattress. So it was only a matter of time people actually did it. So the fact that we were always looking to reduce volumetric weight, we would have got there at some point in time.
I think you should have just hired Siddharth. Siddharth is strong enough to do 6 to 8 tons of force on that mattress. I have a question, and this might be a difficult question, Matthew. We spoke about Casper for a while. Like Casper, they innovated on this, and they were the big D2C brand in the early 2010s, right? But now, if you look at where Casper is, it's practically bankrupt. Their stock price is like practically down to zero. And a lot of people have been seeing that as like, the warning bell that D2C doesn't work.
Yeah.
What is your opinion? What separates you from, how is your business model from what Casper was doing? And how are you going to avoid, that pitfall of where Casper went into?
Yeah, so, I mean, there are a lot of examples you can actually learn when you really study somebody's P&L and a balance sheet, right? I mean, I think they actually spent on marketing more than what they can actually chew, to be very honest. I mean
that was the biggest criticism, right? Is that mattresses is a one-time purchase and they spent so much on customer acquisition. That was, I think, the biggest criticism of
Casper. Yeah, correct. But I think what we have to dig a bit deep to really understand is how does the US population function? What is their per capita? What is their disposable income? And where did Casper play? I mean, we all know of Casper because they were very flamboyant. There are many like Casper, right? I mean, there is Purple, there is Tuft and Needle, there's Nectar. But we all know Casper because they did spend the most on marketing. But there are other brands which I don't know if you guys would know of, but they are 3 times the revenue of Casper. I'm talking about D2C brands. There are brands like Zinus. There are brands like Maloof, which is probably reaching about $1 billion each in revenue, and Casper's was revolving somewhere about $300 million. But they did not do the flamboyant game. Now, why did Casper not succeed? I mean, if you look at, I mean, this is where really customer profiling comes and really understanding where your customers are and what do they need, right? We're talking about a typical US customer who's probably on an average has about $20,000 to $25,000 per capita. That's where they are today.
It's around 50,000, 50,000.
Okay, yeah. So, when someone at 50,000, when the audience is at $50,000, they probably wouldn't want a Casper. They would go for the Series and Tempos of the world. But when they don't have the, we're talking about someone without 50,000, per capita, they would go for the Zinus or Maloof of the world. So what happened to Casper is they kind of got sandwiched between the top end brands and the low end brands. So, I mean, I think it's a typical problem of not really understanding, you know, who your audience are and who's going to buy your products. They kind of fell in between. I think that's typically what happened to a Casper. I mean, if you look at Purple, who's still doing better, much better than Casper. I don't think even their share prices are great, but they kind of position much more premium than what a Casper position themselves as. They, you know, kind of position towards your Sealy's and Serta's and Simmons of the world. So, you know, that's, I think it's a typical mistake of not really understanding who you're selling to and, you know, where your brand needs to play. I think they kind of fell in between the top end guys and the low end guys. Your Zynus and Maluf are 1/3 the price of Casper's, and they were 3 to 4 times the revenue and EBITDA positive. These are all EBITDA positive companies, both the low end ones. So, and at $1 billion approximately.
Yeah, I think what also happened with Casper is I think they fell into the venture capital trap, which is in order to raise the next round, you have to sell and show the top line, in which case you have to spend a lot more on marketing where the unit economics goes for a toss. And this argument that you can get back unit economics in order after a certain point in time probably makes sense for a software company where the marginal costs are not that great or not that high, like as Google. But that whole argument doesn't apply to an operational company. You need to be unit economics at that, you know, order transaction level on day one, especially for a mattress company, right? Because, and this is now going back to the question that I had in my mind earlier, which is the lifetime value of a customer when it comes to mattresses, right? It might be high in terms of the absolute amount, but the number of transactions that you probably get to do are very low, because the category is such where if I buy a mattress today, I probably for a few years don't need a mattress again.
About 7-8 years. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So how do you sort of internalize that as a fact of the market, as a rule of the market, and try and build a business around this?
Yeah, very good question. In fact, a very investor-led question, to be very honest.
I mean, we are trying to invest in your company, Matthew. This whole podcast is a sham.
Sweet. So, very good question. So, we look at it two ways, Siddharth. One is we look at LTV slightly differently. I mean, we look at it in a way where if Siddharth buys a mattress and if we give Siddharth an incredible product at a very good price and a really good experience, you know, as like us humans, we love to talk about either great experiences or
really,
you know, really bad experiences. It's usually a conversation starter, right? And that's exactly what we bank on. It really works, because when we talk about mattresses as a category, not many people know a lot about mattresses, like you guys were mentioning before. So invariably, what will happen is when you're going to do a 10,000 or a 12,000 or 15,000 rupee investment into mattress, you really will tend to ask other people saying, guys, do you know of a good mattress? And that's where the LTV plays for us. I mean, the recommendation which we have is just incredible. So that is one way which we look at LTV, because people using, people because of experience recommending a brand and products is superb. Second is we've also ventured into other products in comfort space to home. So one of the biggest questions which we were asked at, you guys are selling mattresses, why don't you sell me a cot? Because I need to buy a cot as well. So we did venture a bit into home and furniture where, we got into wooden cots, sofas. And I mean, this is kind of a testament to what we did in the last 3.5 to 4 years. We launched a furniture category about 4 to 5 months back. I mean, in fact, we launched a campaign with Ranveer. I think this year it's going to probably do about 20% of our portfolio, of our revenue in just a month. I mean, in just 4 months to 5 months, we're seeing that traction. And when I say 20%, we're talking about 50 crore in the first month, 40 to 50 crore in the first year, not month, first year. And we're talking about, again, unfortunately, these are products, again, which are very high valued and low LTV. But again, our LTV, not LTV, our ASPs are multiplying on a much bigger quantum rather than a small amount. So a 10,000 rupee product with a 18,000 rupee cot, and our sofas are starting from 15 to 18,000. So, you know, the quantum increase is substantial.
So I feel like, Siddharth, you very sneakily, slyly snuck in that you guys are doing around 250 crores a year of revenue. Now, I was quite impressed by that number.
I was, like you said, it's always interesting going through financials, and I was going through Sleepyhead's financials. What happened in 90? So there is a decent growth that happens up till 1920. And during that lockdown period and the last two financial years, there has been a significant jump. Was that a planned effort where, okay, now we have product market fit, now we know how this online game works, let's pump in more money into this, and therefore the revenue increased? What changed, or the market changed, or the preferences changed?
So two things. One is you need to take risk. You need to take calculated risk, and we took a risk by pumping in a bit more money when there was COVID. We kind of knew a lot of things were working in our favor. There was lockdowns, which means shops were not open. People couldn't go out and shop. Work from home started. So all these were very strong attributes for us saying, you know, this is the right time for us to invest because people are working from home. And us Indians, we all love to sit on our mattresses and work. And, you know, also when you're sitting at home for a longer time, you kind of realize
how good or bad
what's good and what's not good. So, we had a good jump. I think in 2 years, we jumped from 25 crore to about 150 crore in 2 years. So that was a great jump. I mean, it was really, really understanding what risk you need to take at what point in time. And, really going for, you know, what you aim for when you're actually, you know, putting that risk forward.
So this goes exactly back to the question I wanted, was that you are saying risk, and obviously the risk that you're talking about is the capital that you're investing, right? So where were you investing that capital exactly? Were you pumping money into performance marketing? Were you doing like outdoor ads? What exactly were you doing? Where was that money going?
Most of our communications digital only. As of now, we've not ventured into offline media, primarily because if you really need to do very good offline media, there's no point to actually put a small amount. You need to really do it big bang, and we're not there yet. Most of our marketing is digital only, but yeah, a good amount into performance and good amount into actually creating social content, just so that you know bringing out tips when you're working from home, really making them understand the importance of good sleep, and really understand, basically educating the customers in multiple different categories so that they really understand what we are trying to get at. So yeah, bit of both into performance as well as educating our customers.
So I mean, going from 25 to 250 crores is not only going to come from like you said, social media tips, right? That performance piece is a very big piece of it. And
correct.
One thing that we have heard consistently from D2C founders over the last 2 years is that performance has had a huge hit. Where your Google and your Facebook ad cost has increased significantly. What has been your journey with performance marketing in these 2 years?
So I think it's absolutely right. Whoever raises a point saying digital is cheap, I think it's definitely wrong. It is, if you're looking for a awareness campaign, I would definitely say offline or a television is much more cheaper than, you know, building awareness online. Having said that, you know, when you actually plan your performance marketing at phases, it really brings in and pushes your team to really think what needs to be done, right? You know, how much of your money needs to go to performance? How much of your money needs to go to a, you know, we call it mid-funnel audience? How much needs to go to a lower funnel audience? What kind of communication do you give to your, you know, top level, top of the funnel audience? What are the conversion communication you need to give to your middle funnel or a lower funnel? So a middle funnel audience, we typically say these are the people in the funnel where they need that push to really, you know, believe that Sleepyhead is the mattress they need to go to. So we give them, you know, communication with regard to why our product is good, you know, testimonials of our customers, which they've spoken, how mattresses and products have helped them. These are trust building creatives and communications, which really help them to decide. a lower funnel is probably a price conscious, you know, they probably need a last nudge to probably make the conversion. You probably offer them a, you know, loyalty program or a, you know, a discount if your raw material is favoring you, you know, then. So you need to really understand where and what communication needs to go to which funnel of your communication in performance marketing. So performance marketing, I wouldn't say it's a generic one word phenomenon. No, it's not. It's actually multiple levels and really understanding how each levels need to work. And if you get this strategy right, then you can really optimize and, you know, increase your ROI quite significantly.
So just last question on this performance piece of it, right? Like I've spoken to small founders and large founders who are doing performance marketing. A lot of the small founders say that they themselves spend a lot of their personal time on going through the performance part of it and understanding what is working, what is not working. The large founders, they tend to have teams, they tend to kind of more delegate it, right? What have you seen that has worked for you? Have you spent that personal time in the start to understand it, or did you delegate it from the start?
So I think I'll bring in a bit of culture here as well. The culture which we, you know, build at Sleepyard is just because, let's say if I have a brand head, we have a consolidated meeting where everybody has equal right and authority to ask, even if it's a most simple question. And sometimes, you know, the answer evidently is there in just simple logic. So there is a very strong bond which you need to create culturally, so that cross-functional questioning and cross-functional authority is being created. So I myself will get involved with this as well, so that everybody has an equal say everywhere and cross-question. And I think this is what makes everybody equally, you know, they have the ownership to actually deliver, because they feel responsible, not as just an employee, because they're actually part of a much bigger portfolio as a brand. So, yeah, I would say it's a very good idea if the promoter himself gets down to the basics to, you know, brainstorm with them, because many a times they'll be very scared to actually take a risk. And sometimes you need that promoter kind of a driven push to say, you know what, guys, let's take that risk. If it fails, I'm with you guys. We still need to experiment on what works and what doesn't work. And that really helps the team to, you know, even suggest bigger propositions. And, you know, it kind of enables a risk-taking mentality, which is very important in a, you know, a startup culture.
Yeah, I actually was speaking to somebody, a large D2C brand's CMO. And one of the things that he said is, in performance marketing, there's an arbitrage that exists only for a very small period of time, which is basically you've discovered something that works, that has a very high return on ad spend. And before everybody in the industry catches up, then the consumers are bored and then they're going to start ignoring it. There's that very brief moment where you have to, you know, figure something out and then really maximize it. And then, you know, have an engine that keeps finding more and more of these things, because you can't rely on one of those things for a very long period of time. Is that something that would you agree to?
That's very true. And I think, see, the point which you just made, Siddharth, it requires the risk-taking ability to actually dig, to actually find that space, right? So unless that kind of a culture is encouraged, it's not going to happen. They're all going to sit...
Just to add, it's not just taking the risk. It's also be okay with failing, because a lot of times these experiments will just downright fail, right? Like it doesn't work. And having the capability to say that, okay, one out of these 7-8 might, you know, experiments might work, but one is going to cover up for all the cost that I spent on 7-8.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's exactly, I think you're, you know, double downing on exactly what I mentioned before. I mean, this is where a promoter's intervention there at the brainstorming place is very significant, because that's where, you know, he or she needs to take the call saying, guys, let's just go for it. Sounds like a great plan. Let's experiment on this and see how it pans out. And then, you know, keep tweaking the plans from there.
Yeah. It basically is a performance marketing engine that you need to build, right? It's not one thing that they're doing. They're exploring different platforms, different things.
It's always about tweaking, right? Because when you do something, it's only a matter of time somebody sees what you're doing and kind of replicates the same. Then you need to immediately switch to another gear to, you know, exploit something which is probably not taken by anybody. You know, it's always finding that space where you can play and where you can leverage your money's worth, right?
Yeah, it's very sad that performance is no longer that thing that you can do just like a lone founder doing performance by themselves, figuring it out and all. You do need a team to do performance nowadays.
I predict in the near future, you're just going to put a product, you're going to say who I want to sell it to. And I'm pretty sure, you know, tools are going to come where it'll run on its own. I mean, we're talking about AI, you know, the way AI is coming in. It's only a matter of time. I don't think it's even 2 years away that you probably do not really need a very strong team. You probably need a team to think something very different. Probably not performance marketing, to be very honest, because the way Google's building its engines, it practically knows everything. And a day is going to come very soon where you're going to just say, this is my product. This is who I want to sell it to. This is the audience which I'm, you know, looking at. You press start and it's just going to run on its own.
Yeah, not too far away from that day. And this is happening across different industries, right? The AI, really smart AI coming into place.
I mean, there are many tools today who's just going to give you AI-driven algorithms to say, you know, these are the places where you might be losing money. These are the places where you need to optimize. I mean, if you've reached there, it's only a matter of time. Your ads are going to be run by robots for sure as soon as possible. It's just going to be a start and stop. I mean, start where you put in money, stop and the money's over.
Exactly. The creatives are now being created by the AI engines already, right? You plug data into it. You plug, you know, this is the amount of money I want to spend. They figure out which algorithm where, which platform where they need to spend that money to get the maximum output. And then the race is going to be to build that biggest, the most efficient algorithm there, right? I think that's going to be the race at that point in time.
There is something which we used to run internally called the eyeball effect, where when I was doing marketing, when my creative team always sits different from any other team. And once a set of creatives are done, we actually do a human eyeball test to, you know, individually, just to say where was your first attention to in the creative? Where was your second point of attention, third point of attention? Because that's how you place your, you know, your main communication, your RTBs, you know, there's a science to creative, right? It's only last year there was a AI to do it. And this is something which we would do internally. I mean, internally through experience, right? We never even knew that something like this existed. And last year we discovered there's a tool to actually, you know, do an eyeball test saying if this particular creative is going to be exposed to 1,000 people, it's very likely your first one, two, three eyeball effects are going to be here. I mean, there is always a science to anything which you put out, right? So, yes, no.
Matthew, don't keep us in suspense. What is the name of this tool? Because I need this so desperately.
Yeah, let's connect offline for that.
Okay, because I was literally having this conversation with my creative team yesterday. They showed me a creative. I was like, my eyeball is driven to this, my eyeball is driven to that. And we talk about information hierarchy. So yeah, this is definitely a tool I need as well. Once we find... Okay, yeah. Anyway.
So that... Okay. One sort of last part of the discussion, we mentioned getting Ranveer Singh on as a celebrity, as a brand ambassador. As a D2C brand, one, I want to understand that process of, I think you explained it already, why you need celebrity marketing, you know, even in Duroflex, the kind of people that have advertised for Duroflex and why that credibility needs to be created. So, well, let's skip that part. But how do you evaluate who's going to do it? And second, how do you figure out what the ROI is going to be, right? Because that probably informs on how much can we spend. And if you're spending this much, this is what we need to look at. And it's not always directly attributed because it's not one of those ads that you click on. It's a celebrity marketing for it, right? So how do you internally justify the cost that you spend on getting a celebrity?
Yeah, again, Siddharth, a very investor-led question. So, for us, like I mentioned before, Sleepyhead was always designed to be a very young, vibrant, you know, colorful brand. And if you actually put these 4 or 5 factors into a piece of paper and we ask 10 different people, can you resonate a celebrity with it? By default, it was Ranveer Singh for us. But having said that, I mean, this is a very easy way to say it, but we did our own research as to why we wanted Tanvi Singh. But when, I mean, point blank, right? End of the day, your brand needs to resonate to a human. I mean, you know, a brand always needs to have a personality. Only then it kind of, you know, comes alive to actually portray who, you know, they stand for. So we knew from day one what Sleepaid needs to stand for. And for us, it was relatively easy choice because when we actually did this exercise, you know, the character which easily got pushed to was Ranveer Singh, because he kind of had all the aspects of what we were looking for in terms of energy, in terms of appeal, in terms of style, in terms of quirkiness and everything. So it was a correct fit. Now, the second aspect of the question on ROI, like I mentioned before, there's always a risk which you need to take for to elevate your brand from A to B. Now, when you're taking a celebrity for X, it is thumb rule you need to spend 5X of, you know, what you signed him for to actually promote. Otherwise, you're not going to get there. One of the main reasons why we wanted Ranveer was, again, to give out trust and credibility on the products which we sell to a very young audience, you know, who's only exploring our products in the online space. It becomes a bit difficult to sell comfort products, which is a very touch and feel product in online, because, you know, end of the day, how much ever you write in content or in, you know, a pictorial representation, a comfort cannot be expressed, you know, over a screen. So you do need that a big trust factor or a face which, you know, communicates this factor across, so that there is, you know, a lot more trust built, you know, for a consumer to actually, you know, buy into a brand. I mean, it. So today, if Sleepaid was going live tomorrow, it's very likely that we wouldn't have taken a brand ambassador, because there are other factors which you need to build in before you get there. So, for example, your social proof. You know, our products are sold on, you know, the Amazons and Flipkarts of the world. We have a consolidated of, I think, about 40 to 50,000 reviews on our product. And these are, you know, 4.4, 4.5 plus. So there's already enough credibility and social proof which we built as a brand. This is just going to add, you know, like an energy to whatever we've built. Because from day one, when if you need a celebrity to actually sell for you, I don't think you've thought enough in terms of what your strategy is, you know, how are you going to acquire your consumer, because you're totally depending on the celebrity to do that for you. And that doesn't work. Yeah, unless you really understand your value proposition, your, you know, the strength of your brand, you're just using the celebrity to actually, you know, push that further so that you get that additional mileage. Yeah.
So I want to take what you just said one level deeper. You said that you can't start with celebrity endorsement because you need to have some kind of strategy, right? So what was your strategy on getting that first customer? Who was that first customer? I'm sure you know that person's name in your mind. Yeah. But what was your strategy to get those first, like, initial push off the ground?
So, yeah, I think a lot has changed since day one. To be very honest, like I said, we were very new to the game. We did our best to really understand what would work. And I still remember we were a two-member team that day. And I think we went live 23rd of October 2017. And we got our first order on 29th of October. So for the first, you know, we were practically sitting idle, not knowing, you know, what next, right? Because we just went live thinking we did whatever we could. And yeah, we still remember our first customer. His name was Deva Prakash. I don't think I'll ever forget him. He was from Bangalore. It's a different kind of a feeling, right? Then you're calling the customer just to say, you know, you'll get your product on so-and-so day. Did you like the experience? How did you discover our brand? So I think so much has changed since day one, but sometimes it's always baby steps and you're going to get there soon. You're never going to, you know, be 100% perfect. You can't be 100% perfect before you go live. It's always constantly reinventing yourself and constantly making things better so that, you know, things go smoothly day by day.
Yeah. It's one of those things, right? You have to do a lot of those things that don't scale. As Paul Graham says it initially, yeah. Just talking to people, trying yeah. to understand how they discovered you so that you can focus more on that and try and figure out distribution channels.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to close out the episode. Matthew, thank you so much for giving us
one last question before we close it out. One last question, because this is a mattress episode. Which is your favorite mattress and what would you recommend?
Or, that no, I sleep yeah, in? Okay. Favorite or which one do you prefer? Yeah.
When you're a promoter, you have to keep experimenting on your products. So I'm actually experimenting one of our new products. Unfortunately, my wife gets pretty annoyed because we kind of change mattresses, you know, in every 8 months to 10 months because, all our promoters and all our executive people has to go through, you know, experiencing different mattresses. So currently, I'm currently sleeping on a mattress which we are planning to go live in the next 6 months. But it's a different kind of a mattress. So we are all experimenting on that. Yeah.
I actually have another question. When do you think an 8 sleep like mattress comes into India? Is that happening soonish?
So maybe I'm experimenting on one of those.
Oh, nice.
Wait, what is that? So that I don't know what that is.
It's a temperature controlled mattress.
Nice. I can't wait to. I'll be in the market for mattresses in a year and a half anyway. So I'm excited.
I mean, the way we look at it from an R&D perspective, Siddharth and Sahil, is, you know, how can you improve, you know, sleep, right? I mean, why wouldn't you understand what kind of sleep Siddharth or Sahil got throughout the night when you're sleeping on a mattress for 8 hours? So what if there's a mattress which can tell you saying your body is, you know, 80% energized and you're good to go and you got, let's say, this percentage of REM sleep throughout the night or deep sleep throughout the night. I mean, I don't think any mattress brand has gone beyond just offering a product. Mm. I don't think anybody's gone beyond, you know, to really explain the science of sleep to a consumer. And we're heading that way. So you're going to see some interesting products from us pretty soon. When I say pretty soon, maybe 6 to 8 months down the lane. Yeah.
Nice. I'm excited. All right. Matthew, thank you so much for taking us through the entire mattress industry, how it operates, what the journey of Duroflex was, what the journey of Sleepyhead was. I can safely say, and I'm sure there were a lot of people involved, but you sort of reinvented both the businesses. The first one was obviously a new business, but Duroflex coming in 2010 and sort of changing the direction and making it a top brand in India now, and creating Sleepyhead from the insights that you got at Duroflex. The journey has been fascinating. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you so much, guys. And thank you for having me. And I'm glad I could share my experience. And it was a good talk. Thank you so much, guys.